Speaker for this evening, Paul M. from El Cajon. Paul Alcoholic. It's a pleasure to be here. my sobriety date is January 17th, 1994. Continuous sobriety is my first time getting sober, but I had nothing to do with it. My first drink, I first started partying back, I don't know, 12, 14 with everybody else. My first drink was some whiskey, and I didn't like the taste of that. I think it was about 8 years old. Then my first drunk, somebody had told me that if you drank a beer with a straw, you'd get drunk. And so and we were having this little camp out. You know, I don't know if anybody ever did this when I was a kid. We have little camp outs in the backyard. I set up these little tents, and so we went into this my friend's refrigerator, his dad, and we got this can of Schlitz Colt 45 malt liquor. Yeah, I had no idea, and so stuck the straw in that thing, and man, I just started running around in circles and ran into a tree, and that was what was going to happen the rest of my drinking career. Yeah. On and on, you know, things like that. But something happened is that, you know, when I was a kid, and even when I first got sober, I couldn't talk. I stuttered. You know, so some of these things that, you know, some of the things that get talked about in meetings about call somebody every day and all this stuff, or, you know, I couldn't do that. You know, I couldn't do that. I came here because I couldn't stop drinking, and I can't talk, you know, and I'm angry because I can't, you know, because I figured out I got this thing. And, you know, where's a guy like that supposed to go in some meetings where you can't, you know, you really can't communicate? I don't know if anybody here has ever been around somebody with a really severe speech impediment and you want to finish their sentences, right? Well, that's what would happen, but I'd punch you, you know? It wasn't personal, you know? And so when I get sober, right, this thing just spinning around in circles because that's what happens. Right, the mind moves so fast the vocal cords can't translate, and I got all this stuff going around in my head, you know, and I had no idea what any of this stuff meant. My drinking career started, you know, like I say, you know, when I stuck that straw in that that Schlitz Colt 45 malt liquor, and you know, and it was on, and then I went to work. You know, I always fancied myself a worker. Even as a kid, I always found these jobs, you know, like cleaning floors. In these stores, you know, so I started cleaning this floor in this little 7-Eleven type thing. Anybody remember Boone's Farm? Right? How about Ripple or Mad Dog 2020? Yeah. Right? Well, that stuff was there, you know. I'm this little 12-year-old kid mopping the floors, and so I would steal a bottle of wine, you know. I mean, I'd steal a bottle of wine, and off I'd go, and, you know, and so that's how I got started. And in our literature, it talks about that, you know, the progressiveness of this illness, and it kind of talks about the three types of drinkers. You know, we're the moderate drinker. Well, when I was in elementary school, I could take it or leave it alone. You know, I mean, that's just the way it was. And then I got into high school, and I'd become a continuous drinker, but if given sufficient reason, such as like football or wrestling or because you're not supposed to be drinking at 17, 18 like that, you know, that I was able to stop or moderate. But after I got out of high school, it was on. It was on. And, on and on, it just continually got progressively worse, right? I think the first time, my first DUI was in Michigan, you know, and that's where you could drink there at 18 years old. I'm like 17 or 18, you know, when I got my first DUI there. And then my second DUI was in Indiana. And I don't know if anybody's ever experienced this or not, but this apartment that I had was right across the street from the courthouse. Right, and one Sunday night we're like partying, or just partying like heck in this right across from the courthouse. And I had to take this girl home. Well, in between me taking her home and winding up there, I got arrested for drunk driving. And so the very next morning, I'm in these shackles and handcuffs, right, getting taken out of this bus into this court, and my apartment's right there, and those people are still partying. And I'm being drugged into jail to go see this cop. Yeah, over and over again, my drinking just got progressively worse. And after that DUI, it occurred to me that I need to get out of that town. I just need to get out of that town. And I'd love to say that I joined the Navy out of virtue, you know, because I want to go serve my country, but that's not the truth. That's not the truth. I need to get out of there, right? Because they're, you know, like in 3 years, two DUIs, I see the writing on the wall, right? These guys are either going to lock me up or I'm going to go, you know, one of the two, right? So I managed to slither into the Navy. And the only reason I chose the Navy was two things, was they played chess and they drank. That was my whole reason, not to be a good guy and serve my country and, you know, all that stuff. It wasn't nothing like that. It was like that they played chess and they drank. I never played a single game of chess in the Navy. Not one. You know, but that was one of the reasons. And so the problem started right out of boot camp. I started drinking this Bacardi 151, and that stuff kicked my butt, you know. You know, so in the chapter more about alcoholism, where it says we went from this to this to this, when I got into these rooms, I was kind of doing a checklist of things that I'd done. Just about every single one of that list I did, right? Only drinking natural wines, right? I knew what they were talking about because that wine I was drinking was not natural. It was not natural. Boone's Farm, back then, if it had a cap on it, it was not natural. There were no grapes in that stuff. And so all these things, and I started, you know, it was one thing with peppermint schnapps, you know, and that didn't work. And then Bacardi 151, and then Tequila, and then all this stuff. And then finally just got down to beer. You know, and by this time, they were kind of like not asking me to re-enlist in the Navy. Yeah. Yeah, I'll tell you a little story about this Navy escapade. You're constantly fighting in the Navy, right? Because in my mind, I'm kind of a visual person. You know, like a machinist mate is supposed to fight with Marines. You know, if you're in the Navy, you're supposed to fight with Marines. That's just how I saw it. And so I'm in this bar, and for no particular reason at all, there's a Marine sitting there, and I smash him upside the head with a beer bottle. Just to start a barroom brawl. Because I'd never experienced one before. So we're fighting. And anyway, I go to jail. You know, there's a trend here. You know, I just keep going to jail. And so they kind of pardoned that in the Navy back then they wouldn't now. You know, because I was a good worker and, you know, I just worked. And so we were pulling out for our first Westpac, and I was on the Kitty Hawk. And just as soon as we got out of San Diego, I got this message from the American Red Cross that my biological father had just died. Well, I didn't know this guy. He left us, my mom and us kids, back when I was 6 or 8 years old. I didn't know this guy. I didn't know him. And so at first I wadded this piece of paper up and I threw it in the trash can. And then the thought occurred to me, I get emergency leave. Right? See, I'm maybe a drunk, but I'm not stupid. Yeah. So I get this piece of paper out, you know, straighten it up, put this sad face on because I'm an actor, you know. I could portray these character, right? So I go up to the chief engineer, and next thing I know, I'm being catapulted off the Kitty Hawk, right? And I never made it to this guy's funeral. I started partying. I just started partying for like a month and a half, nothing but partying in San Diego. And then finally they got, you know, tired of me here, and they were shipping me back over there, you know. And the ship was in Philippines, was in Ilongapo, right? And that's where I was supposed to meet the ship, right? Well, these orders that I had said fly to Manila. And so as I'm driving in this little jeepney from Manila to Ilongapo where the ship is, it occurred to me that I had completed these orders. It didn't tell me what to do after that, right? So I started partying. I just started partying, and then it's kind of a strange feeling to be a sailor in this foreign country standing on a pier where there used to be a ship and the ship's not there. And so I'm standing there, and they arrest me for, you know, for missing appointed place of duty, AWOL, you know, some shit. And so I'm like this guy who, you know, I always try to figure out a way to get out of things. You know, I got this intellect, so I think that most things I can do, you know, just like bull crap my way out of this. And so I'm sitting there in front of this master at arms, and I'm showing him these orders, and this guy's getting pissed because it's right. How could I be charged with missing appointed place of duty when I wasn't given one? And these guys just hated that. And that's just one thing after another where I always rode that edge. You know, not quite in trouble, but always on the verge of going to the brig over and over and over again. And I finally slithered out of the Navy with an honorable discharge, you know. And then my first job was in this pizza place, Godfather's Pizza, you know. You know, I want to go to school, want to learn refrigeration, want to, you know, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to tackle the world. You know, and what a great place for a potential alcoholic to work with all the keys to Godfather's Pizza, where they got all the beer and wine at night, you know. And so it worked out well, and so, you know. It was a great place. And so the next job, this is pretty, you know, this is one that just, you know, that's still kind of funny, is that I went to work for the Hotel Del. I went to work for the Hotel Del. I'm running their power plant, right, the cogen plant, and I'm always coming in kind of like drunk because, you know, because I'm working the night shift. And so I can, you know, always have time to sleep it off before I have to get up and do some real work, right? And I did it for years. I did it for years in the middle 80s, you know. And then one night I woke up and all these alarms are going off and the generator's on fire, right? You know, like, hello. And so I go up and I get the thing shut back down, get the alarm shut off, grab the extinguisher, put the generator out. And what happens is that you need to you get the generator back up in parallel with utilities. Anyway, long story short, what I'd done in my time at Hotel Del was I had acquired this thing for copper, right? It's recyclable. It's easy beer money, right? And so we had all this spare copper sitting around that's supposed to be used for repairs, such as what was just going to happen. But I had stolen all the copper, and there was no wire there for repairs, right? And so I'm groggy, right? And, you know, just trying to get this thing up and running. I'm kind of closing one eye, and you need to push a button at a particular time to get the generator up and running. It didn't work. I couldn't see it. I pushed it at the wrong time. The generator blew up. Generator's gone. Right? There's a little. And then, you know, and then you got this adrenaline happening, you know, you're drunk and you're excited and the bosses are coming in, you know, and so what do you do next? And so I'm trying to reset this breaker with this handle, and it comes off in my hand. And, you know, and so I'm sitting there thinking about this. I'm drunk, right? I blew up the Hotel Del. I've stolen the wire that's supposed to be used to fix this thing, right? What kind of lie am I going to make up now? And the next job I had, over and over again. You know, I could go on and on about just little escapades like that, right? I'm a thief to support my alcoholism, you know. But if you know, I'm going through this thing, and I'm going to school, and I'm learning things. I'm studying refrigeration. I'm studying electrical. I'm going into these bars, and you know, trying to be their hero. You know, these little beer drinking bars with the little smelly with the naugahyde cushions and the cracked mirrors in the back, right? You know, that's my type of beer, beer bar, right? And so I'm going in there, and, you know, these bars, bunches of them, you know? And at first, kind of convincing them that I can fix whatever they got, you know, whether it be ice machines or electrical or plumbing, you know? And so they just keep feeding me beer, you know, and I keep, you know, I keep trying to, you know, fix these things. And then I'd blow their places up and then run like hell. I mean, there was something in there that I'd wind up that I wasn't able to fix, you know, and just keep making matters worse. And so I would always find a different bar, and every time I would go into a bar, you know, a new bar, right, I would tell myself that I'm just going to sit there and drink my beer and keep my mouth shut. And that never happened. That never happened. And so I can remember times after getting in trouble, after going to jail, after, you know, all these things that happened, it's the progressiveness of this illness that I have, right? I would sit there and think, if I can get out of this one, I'll never get in this again. Over and over again. And I kept putting myself in this position, and I didn't know why. I had no idea why. Because, you know, in meetings and in treatment, you know, as I'm getting ready to talk about, in this treatment center that I went to, they talked about this craving. Anyway, what got me here was this apartment complex that I worked in, right? It was the very last one. The wheels are coming off everything, right? I'd given up two kids, you know, because of drinking. I'd just, you know, given up two kids, getting ready to lose the second wife. The house is in foreclosure, right? The wheels are coming off this thing bad. And I need money. And so I'm trying to scam everybody I know, trying to scam and con just to get money to kind of like the pre-Ponzi schemes, you know, right? When you're drunk, you're trying to do that. And so what happened is I was working at this apartment complex. I don't know, maybe you live there. I don't know. And I had the keys to these apartments, and I'd go in and I'd find checks, right? I'd go in and find blank checks, and I'd get a copy of the signature. And forged these checks, and then, you know, off to the bank I'd go. And this, the last bank I went into, I knew from doing proper business, for whatever reason, this bank was going to call and verify funds. They were going to call the account holder and verify this, but I walked in anyway. I walked into this place and presented this check, and they called these people, and they just started looking at me on the phone when they were talking to this person. No, don't know that guy. And so they didn't cash the check, and so the next morning when I went back to work here, the owner was there of this apartment complex. My boss was there, and they gave me my last check and said, the sheriff's department's coming to get you. All right, and what do you do in something like that? You run. Right? So I went home to this house I was losing to the wife that was divorcing me and said, I got to go. And so, I mean, what'd you do? I mean, in a case like that, see, I'm in a lot of trouble, and I know I'm in a lot of trouble, and I need a place to go where I can just sit and think about this and figure out how am I going to get out of this one. I have no intention of getting sober. I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I didn't know anything about any of this. The only thing I knew is the sheriff's department's coming, and I got to go. And so I went home and got, you know, some stuff, and then that night I had made arrangements to go into API the next day, but I needed to kind of like hide out that day. And so I'm partying on the streets of San Diego and, you know, doing a bunch of stuff. I mean, crystal and crack are a little bit part of my story, right? I'm not an addict, but I was just happened to be using them that night. And I mean, I'm not an addict. You know, I can take or leave it alone, that stuff. But anyway, I'm sitting in this truck in Balboa Park, right? Hitting this crack pipe going, holy shit. You guys remember the Northridge earthquake? Right? The Northridge earthquake, that's my sobriety date. I'm sitting in this truck hitting this thing, and all of a sudden the Northridge earthquake comes, and my truck is just bouncing like hell. And it's just going crazy. I'm going, holy shit, I've been doing the wrong stuff. I've been doing the wrong stuff here, you know. But because of that Northridge earthquake, it wiped out all the phone lines, right? And every time I would take a hit or drink a beer or whatever I was doing, I would tell them, I'm going to treatment tomorrow. And so, I went and signed up for this, you know, went into API the next day. And they didn't have the phones back then or the computers to verify the length of my insurance. So I should have only been there for 3 days, but wound up being there for 10. And in that treatment center, those guys screwed me up. You know, they screwed me up. They introduced me to this one theory, and that's all it took, is just one theory, that my body may not metabolize alcohol correctly. And that was something that I had to ponder, you know. I had to sit, because I had time to think about it. I can't run anymore. The cops are out to get me, you know. So this gave me time to think about this one little proposition. And I started thinking about it, you know, and I'll give you an example. Like this water right here, right? I can drink, I don't know, this water, maybe 6 or 7 more today, right? But I'm not going to go out and buy a keg of water to get me through the night, right? So I can tell you, right, that, you know, I have no allergy when it comes to water, right? But when it came to alcohol, it was like when I start to drink, I can't guarantee how much I'm going to drink, right? And that theory kind of messed me up a bit. I had to start, you know, kind of cross-wired, kind of screwed up my thinking here a minute, right? And I don't know about anybody in this room, but when you're sitting in a bar, you know, talking to Joe next to you, you know, drinking a beer, do you ever talk about the phenomenon of craving? Right? Do you ever ask Joe, how's your phenomenon of craving going? Right? That never occurred to me either, so I didn't know anything about that. I knew nothing about that, but coming into these rooms, and that's all you guys are talking about. This craving, this obsession, this spiritual malady, and I'm ready to run again. You know? I had no idea about this thing, and then it was like a ton. It was like a sledgehammer on one side, and this weight off the other. That's what's wrong with me. That explains it. My body physically doesn't metabolize alcohol correctly. That explains it. That explains why when I would go to a bar with every intention at 3 o'clock and being at home at 6 o'clock like I was supposed to and winding up closing the bar down and then driving around later looking for the next party. Over and over again, that explained it. And it's like, that's why. And I got excited at first and then, oh my God, what's next? You know, and what happens to me, especially at that time when I couldn't talk, when I stuttered and I couldn't communicate, my fear came out as anger because I didn't understand what was going on inside of me. I didn't understand what you were talking about. I understood the allergy part because I got experience in that. Right? I could relate to that, but I couldn't relate to this God thing. I'm not going to hug a man, you know, and I can't talk to you. Right? So I can't call you every day. I can't do what you're telling me or what I'm perceiving is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't do it. And so I'm doomed. That's how I looked at this. And I'm in this place, and I was fortunate enough to be on this place called Pathfinders, and that's where I got sober at. And there were some men, some of the men are sitting here tonight that were here when I got here. And those guys told me really, really clearly and plainly, the least important thing around here is what you think. That kind of hurt my feelings. That kind of hurt my feelings, but that was right. You know? And so, as I went through this journey, you know, I'll share this story with you, is that at like on my 30th day of sobriety, right, from the time, from the treatment center to a brief period of time at this house with no furniture, right, because it's being foreclosed in, and at Pathfinders, in 30 days, I got scared and I walked into that house and I had this overwhelming feeling this is where I needed to be. And so, you know, I used to think that I surrendered. You know, I used to think, you know, my ego likes to think that I surrendered. But, you know, but in actuality, surrender is something that happened to me. Right? I don't do any of this out of virtue. I don't do any of this because I think it's a good idea. Right? And so on my 30th day of sobriety, I went down to the Lemon Grove Sheriff's substation. Right, and walked in and turned myself in and said, you're investigating a case and I'm the guilty one. And, you know, I'm here to turn myself in. And the lady behind the counter said, there's nobody here. You got to come back later. True story. And so I went back out to my truck and I sat there. And again, my first instincts are to run. You know, Mexico's right there. Don't you know Mexico's right there? Right, my first instinct is just to run, and at that moment, I had all these things going around in my head of everybody knows the truth now. My family knows the truth. Everybody knows the truth. Employers know the truth. Right, everybody knows the truth about me now. I don't have to play this little scam, this game. You know, I don't have to be something that I'm not. I'm a liar, cheat, and a thief, and this is where I wind up. And I don't have to play this game anymore. So I walked back into that sheriff station and said, no, I'll just wait. And I waited there. They came and they arrested me and they went to this thing. And then they told me after like 3 or 5 days in jail, I don't remember, it was a long time ago, they told me to go back to this recovery home. And when I'm done with that, program, you know, come back and see him. And I did that. And I spent 9 months in that recovery home, and that changed my life. It changed my life. See, these steps are not an event. My drinking was an event, right? The peppermint schnapps was an event, right? The Bacardi 151 was an event, right? It's something that I did to change me for just a little period of time, right? What I had to learn was that these steps are a kit of spiritual principles that are designed for me to change my outlook on life. And what I know about this illness that I have is I'm going to treat what I have with the spirit or with the spirit. I do not have a choice. Either I'm going to consume a spirit to change my ideas, emotions, and attitudes, or I'm going to do some step work to change my ideas, emotions, and attitudes. You know, I never understood what it meant to be an alcoholic until I started hanging around with this nest of big book thumpers. You know, and what it means, and we read it at every single meeting. You know, it's kind of like the epilogue there. It says, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures, drunk or sober. Paraphrasing. So, our description of the alcoholic, you know, what I had to learn first, and I was sitting in this recovery home and about 6 months sober, I'm coming apart at the seams because I got no spirit in me. This God thing, I was molested as a child in the Southern Baptist Church with these two men, right? And so I'm not going to trust men. I'm not going to trust the church, right? So I'm doomed because you're talking about God and you want me to hug you, right? So I seriously feel like I'm doomed, you know? But a lot of things happened early in my sobriety that changed me. I'm sitting there at this meeting, about 6 months sober, just coming apart at the seams because I got no alcohol, no spirit in me. Right? I'm probably really close to getting drunk at 6 months sober. And a guy from the podium says, when the book says to pray, you pray. When it says to write, you write. And when it says to talk to somebody else, do that. And so that took it right out of the realm of you, took it right out of the realm of me having to communicate with you. And I picked up the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and started reading it. And in that book, I found, for the lack of better words, my salvation. We're starting out from the forward to the first edition. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we've recovered is the main purpose of this book. So this book is going to show me precisely how to recover. And right now, standing here, I'm a recovered alcoholic. I am not in recovery. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I didn't wake up with the obsession this morning. If I don't have the obsession, I don't trigger the allergy. And so what I started to do is I started to read this thing like a third grader. And in my mind, when it said we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women, so what I understood is everywhere in that book where it used the word we, us, or are, they're talking about the first 100 people. They're not talking about me. They're not talking about this guy, you know, they're talking about the first 100 people who wrote the book. And so I started understanding that all I had to do was follow what they said they did. I mean, I've been hearing that, but I never put two and two together. I never put two and two together. And so when the book says to pray, I pray. When it says to write, I write. And so there's two questions in the first step. And this is what I have to have deep down in here. And these are the two questions. According to our literature, and this is my experience as well, when I start to drink, can I guarantee each time how much I'm going to drink? Doesn't matter how many DUIs I got. You know, I got a bunch of DUIs, but that's not the problem. I'm just a bad driver. So when I start to drink, can I guarantee each time how much I'm going to drink? And I can't. And then you start to think about this. If that's all I need to know, then I'd be able to say no and just, you know, just move on and, you know, that'd be it. But see, I got this other thing going on. And the most insane thing I've ever done in my life, I did stone cold sober. Pick up the first drink. And I did that over and over again in light of everything that's happened to me. All those multiple DUIs, giving up the kids, wrecked cars, going to jail. All of those things I can't bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the moment that it comes to picking up that first drink. So in my experience, it's not a question of if I'm going to drink. The question is when. I'm just as powerless today over alcohol as the day I walked in this place. Nothing has changed. I'm just as powerless left up to me as the day I walked in here. And the second step is just a question. And this kind of confused me at first, but I had some wonderful teachers. There was a guy, and I was kind of pondering about this thing when I was sober, and this guy saved my life. He said, God, good early direction. And so that gave me an out. G-O-D, that gave me an out. I can follow this book. I can follow the directions in these books, and they're pretty good. Right? Good, you know, and so that gave me an out. That gave me something to believe in. A power greater than me, which was, in my case, was the book, because I can't talk to you at this moment. I still can't talk. I can't communicate. And so this book and then a decision and then the very first inventory. And I'll tell you, the most awakening thing that I ever had in my life, the most release I ever got, and I think at that moment, you know, sometime around when I did my first fifth step is when I could able to get this quiet enough to start communicating. I know a lot of people are pissed off about that, but that's just, you know, but the reality of it is that this thing was spinning out of control. And I'll share something with you. Those two men that molested me, right, when I was 8 years old, I played the victim card for years. I used that until the wheels came. I played that with women. I played that with teachers. Poor me, you know. Don't you feel sorry for me? And I played that card like it was like no tomorrow. And so I'm doing this inventory, and of course, I write down these two guys' name, and then I write the cause and what does it affect. And then when you get to my part, I'm still a victim. Right? And it was pointed out to me very clearly, although these men are spiritually sick, they shouldn't, no child should have been treated the way I was treated. But how did I let that affect my relationships? And that puts an entirely different twist on that. These guys, there's no doubt about it, they were spiritually sick. Because well-balanced individuals would not have treated an 8-year-old boy like I was treated. And so what my part of all this is although it was tragic, how did I let it affect my relationship for 30 plus years? How many people, how many women did I abuse because I couldn't understand they were spiritually sick? And so I got some freedom from that. Right, knowing that there are tragic things that happen in this world, and there are things that that just because I was there, it changed me. Right, but why do I allow those things to affect relationships? Why do I allow that to? I mean, that's my part, and that was my mistake. And so that was kind of like an extreme growth period, and then I started to understand certain things like. If you want to build self-esteem, you got to do esteemable acts. I started doing these things. And now, there's a set of promises in the book. I mean, some of you guys know me. I'm just right by the book. And, if it bores you, I apologize. You get a better speaker next week. But right? But, this program is more than fellowship, although fellowship's important. It's more than the book, right? Although the book's important. It's this internal feeling. It's this freedom that because of these five spiritual principles that I've been given and use, that I'm able to change my life and constantly work on that. I'm a kind of guy that wants to know why. That's just, I don't know if that's good or bad, but, and I know a spiritual program, it just is. I'm the guy, it's like, when they say, I'll share this story with you and just kind of explain some of it. At 12 years sober, I'm 20 years sober now, right? But at 12 years sober, I was doing some things in the program and doing things in my life that I'm not very proud of. Right, I was lying, cheating, stealing, right? Everything sober that I had done drunk. Right, and I don't know, it's a pretty sad time when you're sitting looking in the mirror with this bottle of vodka going, if I just drink this and go back to that place, they'll understand why I did what I did. And then all of a sudden, this thought rushed into my head. Right, many of us exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it, but don't be discouraged. No one among us can maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. And so all these years, my sponsor used to tell me, you know this stuff, you teach this stuff, but you don't do this stuff. And that really kind of hurt. And so at that moment, at 12 years sober, when I was doing all these shameful things, all these things that were hurting a lot of people sober, right, me and everybody else, right, I'm standing there looking at this, and these words come back to haunt me. These same words that I'd been using and quoting came back to actually take on a new life. And many of us exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it, but don't be discouraged. No one among us can maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. Well, what principles are we talking about? I need to know these things. And so the forward to the second edition, they gave the tenets of the Oxford group. Right? And these were the spiritual principles, as I understand them, from the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they are inventory, confession, restitution, helpfulness to others, and a dependence upon a God. And so all of those things started coming rushing back. And I wasn't doing any of those things at that time. I'm a great three-stepper, or was a great three-stepper. Right? I'm alcoholic. Sorry about that. Let me help you. Right? I did that well for a number of years. And I could teach the book. I could tell you what to do. And matter of fact, I did. I used to chase people off the porch at Pathfinders, And so once I started doing this stuff and started understanding that it had to be more than just words. It had to be something else other than just up there preaching on a soapbox. And so I used to ask my sponsor as I was going through this process between like 12 and 15 or 12 and 20 years, I don't know, whichever, is that how do I turn my passion into compassion? Right? Because I don't have a choice whether or not I work with other alcoholics. I don't have a choice. I have absolutely no choice. I am powerless over alcohol, and so I don't have a choice if I work with other alcoholics, because if I don't, I'm going to get drunk. If the newcomers, if they don't remind me what this illness is about, I'm going to forget. And so I go and I try to help, and then I have this personality that kind of like dominant sometimes, but I learned that I need to kind of tone it down. You know, and turn this passion into compassion. And so, as I've gone through this journey in the last 8 years, it's, you know, things have kind of changed. Things have kind of changed. What I know about this, and again, I said this before, is that I'm going to treat what I have with the Spirit or with the Spirit. Either I'm going to consume a Spirit or I'm going to find a Spirit. And there are about four sets of principles that have come true in my life. And because of the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening, right, it starts out with if we're painstaking at this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. And so I understand that. And then the third step promises really, come true for me. And he said, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We have a new employer. Being all powerful, he provides what we need if we kept close to him and perform his work well. Established on such a footing, I become less and less interested in myself. Who would have thought? Who would have thought that a guy like me that lives so much on that edge, who was always trying to figure out how to get around the system, who was always trying to figure out the next game, the next con, you know, who would have thought in any imagination, in any world, that a guy like that would spend most of his waking moments thinking about helping other people? It just, you know, that's just not possible. You know, so there has to be a power. There absolutely has to be a power. I don't think about drinking unless I'm in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I'm talking to a newcomer, right? He's just not there. So if you're new in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, this thing is what I had to realize is that the illness that I have is in my mind. And so when I wake up in the morning, the first thought is that illness. When I go to sleep at night, the first thought is part of that illness. So how can I treat the problem with the same mind to get me into it? Right? How can I do that? The illness I have is here. And an example of that is kind of like, like I was telling you before, the most insane thing I've ever done, I did stone cold sober, pick up the first drink. In light of everything that happens to me, see, I have this peculiar mental blank spot. And this is what I learned here in these rooms. It's this peculiar mental blank spot that I can't bring into my consciousness with sufficient force. Now, when I got sober, I used to hear, you know, call somebody before you drink, think to drink all the way through. Well, I mean, if it works, great, but I don't have that ability. I do not have that ability. I can't bring into my consciousness those events. And, you know, there are a lot of times I can, but it's that peculiar mental blank spot or that mental twist that fails to hold me in check, or my sound reasoning fails to hold me in check. And if I could call somebody 98% of the time before I drank, would I be a success? That's not the deal here with me. Right, I can see the elephants in the room. I know where the bars are. Right? I know where the bars are. Absolutely. I know how to get liquor. The question is those peculiar mental blank spots, those times where I can't think. And that's the purpose of meetings for me, and that's the purpose of newcomers, is because when I'm blessed enough to see a newcomer coming in and I get to look him in the eye and I get to see that pain and suffering, you know, I get to live the first step vicariously every time I look at them, and that catapults me right back to January 17th, 1994. And I don't have a choice whether I do that or not. And then what I like to do, and whether you think this is sick or not, is that I like to kind of get their attention when they first come in, you know, ask them a question, you know, kind of get under their skin a little bit, you know, kind of get a reaction from them. And then I get to watch them grow. And then as I see them grow, and there's several of you in here tonight that I've watched grow over the years, right? I get to see a power of a God working through you that I don't understand, that I can't make up. But I get to see it in you. I get to see it in you and in you and these guys over here. I get to see it grow. It's a God that I can't make up, not in this mind of mine, right? But it's here and it's powerful. And so if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, pick up the big book and read the black stuff. Right? Read the black stuff. And when it says to pray, pray. When it says to write, write. You know, and when it says to talk to somebody else, do that. And thank you for letting me share tonight. Thank you.